Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Liz Martin.
And we're here at the 74th SVP, that's the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology Conference, in the Estrel Hotel in Berlin from the 5th to the 8th of November. So if you remember last year, we were at LA and we had a brilliant conference there. And we're hopefully going to have the same again this year. So Liz, this is your first one, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the first time I've been to SVP, and I'm really looking forward to it. It's crazy busy, and there are like thousands of vertebrate paleontologists here from all over the world, so I'm really looking forward to it.
I can't really believe just how many vertebrate paleontologists there actually are in this place.
Yeah, it's a little bit crazy, actually.
So what are you most looking forward to in this conference?
I'm looking forward to meeting a lot of new people, and also there's several pterosaur talks and pterosaur posters, so of course I'm looking forward to that.
Is there not a dedicated pterosaur session?
No, there's a whopping 3 talks on pterosaurs this year, so I'll be at those. They're in the archosaur section. So.
But you're not giving one?
No, I'm not doing a talk. I'm doing a poster, though. Decided to do a poster for my first SVP instead of a talk.
So Joe's got a talk, hasn't he?
Yeah, Joe's talking on Friday about some of his fishy things.
His fishy bones.
Yeah, his fishy bones.
And then Laura's just here for support, but she's already got ill. She's got tonsillitis, so...
poor Laura.
She's not going to be doing much talking. She's going to be doing all the editing, so thanks for that, Laura.
What about you? What are you looking forward to as a non-vertebrate worker?
As a non-vertebrate worker, I'm pretty much looking forward to going home. Or beer and sausages. So we had the steak and red wine last time in IPC. Beer and sausages this time.
Sounds like a pretty good combination, really.
But then also, there's so much for me to learn. I know nothing about vertebrate paleontology, so everything I do, everything I hear, I'm going to be learning something new. So that's pretty cool. So with so many paleontologists here, if you have any episode requests, please send them in. We've got plenty of time to go off and find specific interviews that you want to hear about. So get a message in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. So when you walk into the poster sessions, the first thing that immediately captures your attention is this giant...
Phytosaur.
Yeah, one of those. It just looks like a giant crocodile or alligator model. It's just its head sticking up with all of its teeth poking out. And here with it is Esben Horn of 10tons.dk. And you create models, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Models for natural history museums and aquariums around the world.
So how would you create a model? Is it based on scientific...
It is, yeah. Sometimes the museum provides me, especially Germany, are good at giving me lots of papers showing all the small details on the legs of crustaceans or whatever it is. But I also, every time I get a job, if there's no reference or scientific material, I try to find out who's the expert on the internet and contact them. And most of the time, people are very helpful. And Jakob Winter started me up, actually. I think he helped me on some of the first paleontological reconstruction. I'm not a paleontologist myself. I'm a artist model maker. So I need scientists to help me to get it correct.
Yeah, I think we've already got a couple of pictures of your models on our website already. I think on the episode 12 Paleozoic Problematica, there's a multiplicophoran, and then on the anomala carotid episode, there's a I'm trying to remember what it's called.
Lagania,
that's the one. So yeah, check those out. But so this alligator here is pretty much, it's not an alligator. What is it?
It's a phytosaur.
Phytosaur.
It's a prehistoric reptile.
So it just looks like a reconstruction of what it would have looked like. But then we've also got other models that are kind of look like they're made out of glass, the translucent. So how are those ones created?
We always say, whether it's a big dinosaur or a small crustacean or a jellyfish, we make it from a prototype from something. It could be clay, or it could be like this here, it's a plastic, a foam plastic. So you can carve it with a knife and sandpaper. Actually, it's more what you like to make it from. I like a clay, just water-based clay. It's non-toxic, it's easy to move around, and but sometimes if you make crustacean legs, it's nice to have something hard. Clay is not good for that. So you start to make a prototype, and from whatever, then we make a silicone mold, and then we cast it in resin, and you can dye it with different colors or fillers to make it translucent or semi-translucent or opaque. So that's more or less the process.
So some of the things like your crustaceans and your jellyfish have colors inside them.
Yes, yes.
So how do you go about that? Is it just kind of like a layering?
We have different techniques. Sometimes we make a model, when you make a prototype, of course, you can handle it. Then you make a silicone mold, take out the prototype, then you have a hollow model. And then we can make it, if it's a fish, we have a prehistoric fish that's translucent, and you can see the gut intestines inside. Then we made the intestines, paint them, put them into the mold and keep them in the right place and fill resin. So in that way, we make something, put it into the mold and cast it in. Other times, we are making deep sea fishes right now. Then we make a cast in semi-translucent resin, fish flesh color. And then we grind off the surface. So we actually take off 5 millimeters of the cast. Then we paint it, and then back into the mold and put another layer of translucent resin. So it is a quite a tough thing to do, but I think it's very important to get it, looking natural.
And what's the biggest model that you've ever made?
We made a 12-meter mosasaur for a geological museum in Denmark, and we actually made a microscopic for it's outside Novozymes building, so it's 12 meters tall.
Wow! And the smallest. How intricate can you get?
This one is the smallest. It's 2 centimeters long. And actually, it was quite an interesting job we got from a Natural History Museum in Stuttgart. They wanted the British shale. It's a very famous fauna from the early life. And most of the time, we make blow-up models, make them bigger.
Yeah, you scale them up.
Yeah. This time, they wanted them to be one-to-one, and that means small. So we went the other way, and we made the prototypes big, so we could get every little detail correct. And then we were shrinking the molds with some nasty chemicals. And then generation by generation, you can make them smaller and smaller and smaller until you get a very detailed, very small models. And the smallest one we made was Hallocygnia.
The
20
little worm millimeter. With the spikes.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the smallest one we made.
Just 2 centimeters.
Yeah, so. It's like a Kinder egg something.
Well, there's an idea. Kinder eggs with fossils in.
It would be very expensive Kinder eggs.
All right. Thank you, Espen.
You're welcome.
So some voices you should all be familiar with are those of the Pastime podcast. And we're here with them now, and you've got a poster about some classroom techniques that you've been using with your podcast. Could you give us a little explanation of what's been going on?
So when we originally set out to make the podcast, our goal was to be able to talk to an audience of young students, like that we'd be able to hit people like 7 to like 13 would understand what we were talking about. And in order to actually prove that, we started reaching out, and Jennifer was especially successful in reaching out to classrooms to actually work with us using the podcast to teach students, which then became a much bigger project.
Yeah, we were really interested in being able to connect with students, but unfortunately, it's very time intensive and very labor intensive to go visit classrooms, especially if you're bringing specimens. So we decided to try Skyping into classrooms. And in doing so, we found that not only can we show them a lot of specimens, but we can show them museum collections, which most of the public never gets to see.
So how does the podcast fit into this?
There's a lot of background information that goes into understanding paleontology before you get to the research part of it. And so the public has a passing familiarity with a lot of paleontology, but they don't really get into the research. So we use the podcast to give them a background on certain subjects, and then when we Skype into the classroom, they already have that background. And so instead of giving them a lecture, they just interact with us directly and ask us questions.
So students are already armed with things like the names and the places that we'll be talking about, and the teachers can use those to point at a map, so that then when they come to us, the questions that they've been thinking about for the previous couple of days can finally be thrown at us, and they build on those questions as we talk to them. And it ultimately, hopefully, makes scientists seem more approachable. Like, you can ask us questions and we'll respond. We're not just going to talk straight at you and then tell you everything we know and there's nothing for you to say back.
So what kind of feedback have you been getting from the students?
We were really kind of touched by the feedback that we got. A few of us had tears in our eyes when we read through them, because we were told by the students that they had never talked to a scientist before, so they were so happy to talk to a scientist. And I don't think we were really expecting that they would hold us in such high regard and be so excited to have the opportunity to interact directly. And that was really the key, was not that we lectured them, it was that we listened to their questions. And a lot of them in their thank you notes to us said, "Oh, I have one more question. Can you just please write my teacher back with the answer to this question?" And I would say probably about 25% of the letters that we've gotten actually have more questions. You can't answer enough questions.
And we've tried to solve that problem, but we've made like videos and like audio for classrooms to like have them play, so we can like get through it really quickly. I think it's also important just to kind of hear the voices and hear that there are people behind these proclamations. Because a lot of, you know, the dinosaur books that they're looking at, like, the author name kind of drifts away. It just becomes facts on a page. And the idea that there are people, like your parents, like the people you interact with, who are working on this, and this is something that you can envision yourself doing as well, I think is a really important part of putting personalities to this work.
Yeah, some of the comments said, "I didn't think scientists could be so normal. You guys are really cool. I'm so surprised. I never thought I could be a scientist, but maybe I could. Before today, I never wanted to be a scientist, but now I really like it."
Were you thrown by any of the questions that you got asked?
Well, what's really interesting is that I moderate a forum online called Ask Science on Reddit, and I see hundreds of questions every week. And the most common questions we get, and this is mostly an American audience, 18 to 35, most of the questions we get there were the same questions we got from first graders and from sixth graders. So the same common theme is there, the same confusion on certain topics is there, and the same interest is there. So it's really interesting that you can kind of start to pinpoint these common gaps in knowledge or areas of interest. So I actually wasn't terribly surprised by the kinds of questions we got. At some point, I think we were a little bit surprised that some of these students really knew a lot about paleontology. So we were getting high-level questions. It was great.
And sometimes there's just really fun questions where you just wonder what else the students were talking about that fed in, like, in talking about mammoths and mastodons. There's a student who asks if elephants are helpful. Which was, it's like, yeah, elephants are totally there to help you out. They act like bulldozers in some places. there is this part that when you start working with students who don't have a lot of conceptions or misconceptions quite yet, just the free association really actually leaves us energized, like, at the end of these, just, like, with the breadth of questions that, like, we are totally able to tackle. And it's they kind of end up giving us a lot of their energy for this subject in return, which is really exciting.
And do you think this could be used as a model for classrooms all around the world? Or do you think you could get into classrooms all around the world with this?
We have. There was a French classroom that brought us in. That's one of the beauties of the whole video conferencing idea. Like, there's a French, they're outside Paris. We talked to a classroom in New Zealand, which was cool because it's the first class we've talked to that knew what a tuatara was as we were, like, talking about reptile evolution. And that's kind of the beauty of this, of using Skype to reach out, is you don't have to transport the fossils. It's really only an hour commitment on our part to talk to them. We're not traveling to or from a classroom. And it gives different places access. We're looking to talk to classrooms in India, because a lot of the fossils we have from Madagascar are closely associated with material that comes from India. So it'd be cool to talk to students there about this material that's from very far from where they live, but it's closely related to a lot of the animals in their backyards. And so there's a lot of potential for global reach and for paleontologists from India or from China to reach out to students in the U.S. and kind of share all of this material globally.
Or even just classrooms that don't have a natural history museum anywhere near them. So these students will never be able to see a natural history museum, especially not on something like a field trip where they're really getting an educational background. So it's been, within the U.S. and outside the U.S., really, really helpful.
There's less and less funding for field trips, even for students that live in areas with museums or access to fossils theoretically. The funding opportunities for those students to bus to the museum is something that's becoming less and less possible in their budgets. And so this is kind of a way to get that material to students, even that might be local, but don't have access to the museum ultimately.
And for people who might be interested in this service, where do they find information about it?
They can go to the Pastime website for our contact information, which is www.pastime.org, or contact us by email, which they can also find on that site.
Okay, guys, thanks very much, and best of luck with it.
All right, thank you very much.
Right, I'm back with 10 Tons, back with Esben, and I realised that I forgot entirely to ask you about the rock fossils.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Could you tell us about those?
Yes, it's a funny story. It was a Swedish paleontologist, Mats Eriksson, that found two Silurian bristle worms and named them after King Diamond. The scientific name of that one was King Nidus Diamondi, and then he found another one and named it after Lemmy Kilmister from Motorhead, and it's called Calopryon Kilmisteri. And that, I'm a heavy metal head, so I sent him an email and said, oh, that's cool. And it ended up that I promised to make a model of the King Nidus Diamondi. And then another friend of mine, another metalhead, Jesper Milan from Geomuseum Faxe, said, all right, if you make models, I'll make an exhibition. And then we made this very small exhibition, two models and some posters telling about it. And it showed to be a huge success. And so now we made a traveling exhibition in flight cases like Marshall Stack Loop. And it just finished in Oslo, and it's going to Switzerland and Germany after that. And it has a huge leather trilobite named after Sid Vicious from Sex Pistols. And there's a cast of a skeleton of a Masiakasaurus Knopfleri named after Mark Knopfler. It's quite funny.
Did you expect any of this when you first got in contact? Is it a nice direction that your work has taken, that you're able to go around with this exhibition? Completely unexpected.
Unexpected, yes, yeah. I've been working on another jellyfish exhibition for 4 years, and it still didn't happen. And this just happened without anybody expecting it. So that's the way life is.
So you're hoping for any of the paleontologists listening, for them to name some fossils after some metal bands, and
yes,
then we can make some more models for
that
this exhibition.
That would be cool, yeah. And especially if it's bigger animals, because there's a lot of trilobites named after rock stars. But we would like some bigger animals, some dinosaurs.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're here at SVP talking to Betsy Kirk. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, first of all?
Sure. So I'm actually born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, and I did my undergrad at Montana State University, where my senior thesis was actually on dinosaur eggs. And now I'm up at the University of Alberta in Canada, working with Dr. Phil Curry on a weird ceratopsian called Pachyrhinosaurus.
So we're looking right now at Betsy's poster. She's looking at some histology and morphological ontogeny of Pachyrhinosaurus. So do you want to tell us a bit about what that means, first of all?
So what I did is I ended up cutting up nasal boxes. And so Pachyrhinosaurus is weird because instead of having horns on its face, it has a big bony lump called a boss. And so I wanted to understand the microstructure of that boss. And so I wanted to also understand that through the animal's ontogeny, so through its growth. And so what I was aiming to do with this study is to see if I could determine ontogenetic stage based on the histology and based on the amount of secondary remodeling that we see in this in these thin sections.
So did you look at just like one bone, or were you looking at the entire skull? What kind of stuff were you looking at?
For this specific study, I just looked at the nasal boss. I have cut up other ceratopsian skulls all across the skull before, but with this, I was just focusing on, I had an adult specimen, a possible one subadult specimen, and one juvenile. But the adults, I had a couple different versions, so or a couple different examples. So I was looking at kind of a couple different varieties, but the study will be expanded before it is published.
I'm guessing that museums don't really like it when you say, hey, can I cut up your Pachyrhinosaurus? So have you had problems with getting specimens or anything like that?
Actually, so far I've been pretty lucky and I haven't had a lot of problems because the Royal Tyrol Museum is an absolutely fantastic resource. And the thing is, too, I don't ask to cut up pretty specimens or holotypes. I pick out the things that don't really look like much, that aren't going to be on display, that are no real use to anybody but researchers. So the things that I use aren't ever really going to be seen by the public, so might as well cut them up and see what else we can discover about these interesting creatures.
So what have you found so far? Have you been able to make any cool inferences so far?
Actually, yes, I have. So I was able to figure out that you can tell ontogenetic stage based on things like if there's primary osteons, how, you know, what amount is primary osteons, what amount is secondary osteons. Do we see many generations of secondary remodeling where you kind of see osteons overlapping each other? So kind of based on that, I've been able to determine that you can guess ontogenetic stage based on the amount of remodeling. And as you move through ontogeny, the nasal boss actually becomes more and more and more spongy as it gets older.
So for those of our listeners who may not know what something like a primary osteon is, can you kind of explain what that is and why it changes throughout life?
So a primary osteon is just kind of, you can think of it almost like a circle of bone that forms as to house blood vessels or nerves. And so primary means it's the first thing that's laid down. So it's the first little osteon, the first little blood vessel that gets put down. And secondary osteon is as bone grows and it changes, it becomes remodeled. So bone is eaten away, it's resorbed, and then new bone is laid down. And so secondary osteons overlap primary osteons, and this kind of continues all throughout life.
Very cool. So what's next in your study? What are you going to cut up next?
Next is probably continuing to cut up various ceratopsian cranial aberrations, so parietal horns, frills, epiocipitals, nasal horns, supraorbital horns, kind of cut those up and kind of get an understanding of how that looks across ceratopsians, as well as I have to do some description work of another Pachyrhinosaurus skeleton that we have.
Very cool. Sounds exciting. Look forward to hearing about it in the future. And thanks for chatting with us, Betsy.
You're welcome.
I'm here with Nicholas Chan, who's at Macquarie University. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi.
And he's got a poster, Walking with Birds, Hind Limb Evolution with Loss of Flight. So could you just explain to us generally what research you've done?
Sure. So basically what I've done is I've tried to look at how the leg bones of birds has changed as they've lost flight. So doing that, I basically compared the some measurements of the leg bones of flightless birds and compared them to their nearest flying relatives. And basically what I've done is I've kind of put all that into a single analysis and then quantified the distance, so how different the flightless birds are from their flying relatives, and then used those distances to see if there's any correlation with things like changes in body mass and also the amount of time since the flight was lost, and also the size of the landmass in which these birds evolved on.
And are these mostly extinct birds or living birds?
There is a combination of them. So there's a large number of extinct birds. So about two-thirds of my data set of flightless birds are extinct. But there are also some living and some recently extinct birds as well.
And what have you found overall with those correlations?
Well, basically, there's kind of two different stories going on. So there's a group of paleonaceratites. Basically, what you find is that the distal leg bones, so the tibia and the foot bones, become progressively longer the bigger they get. And that also correlates really well with land area. So if they live on a larger landmass, those are also longer. And that's probably due to them having good adaptations for running and also for having a longer stride. But when you look at the other birds, the neognaths, what you find is that there's not really much correlation with anything. So the degree of change can vary quite substantially between different groups. And yeah, there's not really a correlation with any of the other variables.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
So with me now, and you'll probably know him from episode 14A and 14B, Trace Fossils, is Tony Martin. Hi, Tony.
Hi, David. So, good to see you.
Yeah, you too. Tell us, what's new in the world of ichnology?
Well, my poster today, I think, is something new in ichnology. It's about some groovy trace fossils. And by groovy, I mean that literally, as in these are little grooves that were gouged into the surface of a sandy shoreline about 100 million years ago. What made the grooves? Good question. I ask, is it a bird, is it a pterosaur, or something that we don't know about? Why was it making the grooves? Good question again. I think it was maybe a feeding behavior, but it was also possible, because this was a really gritty sand, that perhaps they were ingesting some of the coarser grain sand to use as gastrolysts. Nonetheless, it's an interesting mystery, and I thought I would put these mystery traces out on display so that my fellow paleontologists might give me some ideas about what might have made these.
Okay, so can you describe them to us?
Well, let's see. They have pretty regular dimensions. They're about 15 millimeters long. They're about 3.5 millimeters wide, and only about 1.5 to 2 millimeters deep. Very regular. So this makes me think that it's a small animal with a beak that is gouging the sediment, kind of like what you would do with a wood gouging tool, that you would just skim it along the surface, gouge out a very shallow trough, and then get whatever goodies are out of the sediment there. What's really cool about these is that the trace maker did either these half arc or a full arc sort of pattern, that it goes in a full circle or a half circle, where the trace maker had to have been rotating around a central point to be able to do this gouging.
So it's kind of like a, I don't know, a ray of grooves going around.
Yes, in fact, one of my co-authors on this, because it's in Arches National Park, he suggested we should call it Arch Ichnus.
Oh, I get it.
Yes, yeah. There you
Sorry,
go.
Sorry, it just took me a while there.
That's all right, you probably need a beer.
Yeah, probably. So do we see any kind of, well, you say it could be a bird, do we see any kind of similar behaviors in a bird?
That's a good question, and I think from what I have experienced with looking at modern traces on the Georgia coast, I've only seen one instance where shorebirds do a similar behavior, where they liquefy a sediment, where they get together in a big group, a mob, and they all poke their beaks into the sand at the same place. And what it does is liquefies the sand so that all the little crustaceans come up to the surface and they have a little crustacean feast. And it makes a little depression, this circular depression in the sand. This isn't exactly the same. This is something different. I think this trace was made by an individual animal, or maybe another animal came in later and mined it, and it's more of a mining trace of that surface, and it was more of a firm surface. So I'm going to have to investigate whether there are any modern birds that maybe do a similar behavior. I suspect there are.
Okay, Tony, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.